I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Are we smart enough to know how smart animals are? It's the title of Franz de Waal's latest book. Since he was a young boy, he's been studying a variety of animals, particularly primates, and we've had him on the show several times to talk about bonobos and other primates. He's director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center and a professor in Emory University's psychology department. He's originally from the Netherlands, and he has a brand new fascinating book that is titled, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? He starts the book with a quote from Charles Darwin in 1871. The differences between man and higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind. But interestingly, and he spent some time in the book talking about this, after Darwin, we were prone to downplay animal intelligence, and everything has changed, really, in the last 30 years. So we're paying much more attention to this whole issue. We're delighted to have Franz de Waal with us this hour of the program and to welcome phone calls as we talk about primates and crows and elephants and all kind parrots, all kinds of animals, and the kind of intelligence that they exhibit and what we're learning and why we ignored that for such a long period of time, thinking they were the top of the heap, we human beings. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that is at K Dunn Show. Franz de Waal, nice to have you on the air with us again. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Glad great to be there.
Yeah, nice to have you here. It's a fascinating book. You start the book with this quote from Darwin, and Darwin seems to be more like 2015 than 1871. What happened in all those years that had us not really looking very much at the intelligence of animals?
Well, I think what happened in the beginning of last century is that some people decided that animals were either instinct machines, so that's how the biologists looked at it. They had lots of instincts, or it was all very simple learning what they did. And that was all there was to it, and they didn't even distinguish between animals. So whether you studied an elephant or a rat didn't really matter because it was all the same sort of learning that was going on.
Mm-hmm. You say, and you make us all believe this too, that you never cease wondering about the mental level at which animals operate, and you've been looking at animals ever since you were a young kid, haven't you?
Yeah, I've worked with fish and birds, and later I became a primatologist, but I'm interested in all sorts of animals.
Tell me the story of, you started with fish, didn't you?
Yeah, the fish, as still today, I have big fish tanks.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of fish. And fish are much more variable and much more complex than people think. They have a social life also, you know, and they solve issues in their environment also. And so people always think that fish are very simple, but fish are advanced animals also.
And you looked at them and realized, I think, when you were pretty young, hey, maybe I might be able to do this for a living.
Well, the thing is that as a child, I had sticklebacks, and sticklebacks are little fish that you find in Europe, and the males, they change completely in color when they are in breeding age, and they become like little peacocks in terms of the colors that they have. And I had observed all of this, and I had bred these fish, and then I come at the university as a student, and I hear that there's a famous scientist who even got the Nobel Prize for studies of these little fish, and I thought, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? What I like to do as a kid could be a real career, you know?
Yeah, and look at what happened. It sure became a real career. Did you choose primates for any particular reason? I know a lot of your work has been with primates.
Yeah, I sort of entered the primates by accident. I was working in a lab that had birds and rats, and I got an invitation to work with a professor at a different university who had who was affiliated with a zoo that had the largest chimp colony in the world. It's still the largest colony in the world, and they live outdoors on an island. And so I was put in front of those chimpanzees and watched them for thousands of hours, And that's how my primate career started.
Mm-hmm. And you tell some really remarkable stories. A lot of the book, I focus on the stories, too, because I love to learn about the intelligence of different animals. But when we look at the apes, when we look at bonobos, when we look at chimps, some of what they know is just pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, so for example, with the apes, we always think that animals live in the present. We think about the future, but mm-hmm. animals live entirely in the present. But with the apes, we have all sorts of evidence now that they think about the future. So for example, in the wild, you may see a chimpanzee collect three or four different kinds of tools and then set out to go to a beehive that is far away and then use one tool to perforate the beehive and another one to scoop out the honey and another one to swat away the bees. And so they come well prepared, meaning that they have thought about this issue and they have a plan of how to handle it. And with experiments in the lab, we now also know that there's planning in chimpanzees. And so they don't live in the present. They have, just like us, they can consider the future.
Mm. And I think you start the book with a story about a chimp who was gathering straw, right?
Yeah, that was a very simple thing that happened at the zoo where I worked, where a female collected all the straw in her cage, in her night cage, before she went out on the island, and it was in November, and so the weather was getting cold, and she couldn't know about the cold because she was inside a very cozy and warm building while she was doing that. So the only way to explain that is that she was extrapolating from the day before, where she maybe had been suffering cold, and she had extrapolated to this present day and collected all the straw to have a nice warm nest out there. But that kind of planning is so typical for the apes. They always seem to be thinking back and thinking ahead. And so in our field, it's called time travel, when you can think back to specific events and think forward to specific events. And the apes have that capacity.
Mm-hmm. There have been probably the most publicized things in the field of animal intelligence have been these self-awareness, looking at mirrors, and we hear that elephants have that and apes have that, chimps have that. Is that an important thing to know that there are animals that are self-aware?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion in our field of what it really means, but it is true that to connect your mirror image with your own body is something that very few animals can do. So, for example, the apes can do it, the dolphins and the elephants and humans, and that's basically it. If you put a monkey in front of a mirror, and even if you put a dot on the monkey that can only be seen in the mirror, the monkey doesn't connect that dot with its own body. And children can do this kind of stuff at 18 months or 24 months. So we know that very few species can do it, and then what it means, some people say it means that they are self-aware. I find it hard to accept that other animals, let's say a dog who doesn't recognize himself in the mirror, that they are not self-aware somehow. I find it hard to say. But people connect all sorts of conclusions with it.
Mm. The other thing that's, of course, been of great interest is language acquisition by animals. Huge interest, you say in the book. And yet you also say that you consider humans the only linguistic species.
Yeah, I think that's one of those specializations that we have. So I treat in the book, basically, I don't look at animals as being on some sort of ladder of intelligence with humans at the top. I see each animal has its own special features and its own things that they're good at. And we are particularly good at symbolic communication. And yes, you can teach it to some degree to the apes and to some degree to a parrot. So certain elements can be found in other species, and they have that capacity, but it never gets really to the level of even a three-year-old child. It never gets to the human level.
Hmm. And yet, don't we have animals like dolphins where we're trying to understand their communication system, and it's like cracking a code from somebody who may come here from another planet. We just don't know how to crack it.
Yeah, that's actually a much more promising approach in my view. Instead of taking our communication system of symbolic language and impose it on an animal and see how far they can get with it, which is a very human-centered approach, and we have done that for ages.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of doing that, go to the animal system and see how they communicate and see how complex that is. And actually, what the dolphins do and the killer whales is probably extremely complex. We have no way of knowing at this moment, but there are good indications that it's very complex what they do. And so that's, in my view, a much better approach.
Mm-hmm. Will we ever know?
Oh, I think we will. We will crack those puzzles. And because if you look at the progress we've made in the last 25 years in looking at animal cognition and animal intelligence, there are so many innovative and creative approaches now that I think we will get there.
You think about how far we could have been if we hadn't gone a different direction after Charles Darwin. Why has it been only in the last 25 years? How did the whole movement change, Franz?
Well, there was so much resistance. I don't know why people were so resistant to, as soon as you would say that animals have higher intelligence, they would completely freak out. So the first time this happened was like 100 years ago when Wolfgang Köhler, a German scientist, he would hang bananas high from the ceiling and then give his chimpanzees a bunch of boxes and a bunch of sticks and see what they would do with it. And he said that they would sit around and they would stare at the problem, and then all of a sudden, sometimes minutes later, they would jump up and stack the boxes and reach the banana. And he said they would do that without having previous learning. They would do that based on thinking about the problem. Now, Wolfgang Köhler got vilified. I mean, he got taken apart by people. Even today, you will meet scientists who cannot pronounce the name of Köhler. They can only hiss his name because they're so angry at him because he suggested that animals can think. Even though I think that was a perfectly fine suggestion, and we have a lot of support for what he called insight learning nowadays.
Mm-hmm. And there's that kind of learning with elephants, too. I really like elephants. Tell us about the test in the book where the elephant actually, our view of what an elephant should do, and then the elephant taught people a form of elephant intelligence in order to get food that was up high, right?
Yeah, that was sort of interesting because we always think that the elephant must solve the problems the way we should solve them. And so initially what they would do is they would give an elephant a stick and the elephant would be in a cage, and outside of the cage they put food. And any primate under those circumstances will use the stick to get the food closer and to eat it, but the elephant never picked up the stick to do that. And so they had concluded that elephants are incapable of using tools. And you always have to be very careful with negative conclusions because you can really not prove anything. And you always have to wonder, maybe I didn't do the test right. And then what they found with the elephant is that if you hang the food very high, that they cannot reach it, and you give them boxes that you spread around, they will go out of their way to collect the box and to bring it closer to underneath the banana or whatever the food is, and they will stand on top of it to reach it. So meaning that they are using a tool, they're perfectly capable of using tools, but not with their trunk, because their trunk happens to be also their smelling organ. And so to shut off your smelling organ to reach food is not something that an elephant is willing to do. So they understand the concept of using tools, but we had underestimated, as scientists, that the trunk is much more than just like an arm or something. It is much more than that.
Hmm. It really shows an ignorance of animals in some ways, doesn't it? Not thinking about how they maneuver this earth.
Well, we discover these things pieces by pieces, and the only thing is I'm saying is that you have to be very careful when people say they cannot do this or they cannot do that, because most of the time that means that our methodology is not up to snuff.
We get to talk a lot about crows and parrots and more about elephants and chimps and apes and all of that, and welcome your phone calls. We're going to do that in a moment. Our guest this hour is Franz de Waal. He is the author of Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? He has spent thousands and thousands of hours observing animals, mostly primates, because that's his special area. But he's really been all over the world for this particular book, talking about animals everywhere. So he writes about what he saw and what his studies have shown. He is a professor of psychology at Emory University, and he is director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. Our phone number, one line is open. Take it if you want, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Franz de Waal. We start with Lynn in La Crosse. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to boast about my critters. I have 3 rescue parrots, a cat, 2 mini doxies, 2 sheep, and 3 hens. And every one of them are so smart. My parrots know how to take a stick and scratch the back of their head. My doxies know when I'm emotionally distraught. My hens know to go in at night, and I don't know, it goes on and on. My sheep, they love to be patted. Everybody has just filled my life with love and happiness.
Well, that's good to know. Sounds like you have a good home there. Franz?
Well, you know, that the sheep like to be petted, I'm not sure that for me falls under high intelligence. But that is, it is true that sheep actually recognize faces.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So people have done experiments. Humans, of course, recognize faces, and we now know that the primates recognize each other's face. All of this has been tested with touch screens and so on. But sheep, to many people's surprise, even because they look a little bit similar to us, I would say, they have tested sheep, and they can recognize easily lots of faces, which means that the habit of herders, you know, to fuse sheep flocks or to separate them is actually maybe problematic, because the sheep, they keep a good record of all the ones that they know.
Isn't that something? Well, you got to tell us the story of Alex the parrot.
Well, Alex the parrot, Irene Pepperberg had Alex the parrot at Northwestern University when I was in Wisconsin in Madison, Wisconsin, for 10 years, and so I visited her many times while she was there, and she started her project with Alex at that time, and Alex was being taught symbols. So he would, for example, see a key that was green, and he would have to say whether the key was made of wood or of plastic or metal. He would have to say whether it was green or black or yellow, and he answered those questions, and Alex could do all those things, and people were totally surprised, because they looked at parrots as like, yes, they can mimic sounds, but right. That's all they can do, and it's a bird, moreover, so birds didn't have the reputation of being very smart, but Alex beat everyone, and so everyone was very impressed by Alex.
Mm. Yeah, we use the term bird brain, right?
Yeah, but we now know that the study came out like 2 weeks ago, where they counted the neurons in brains, and they found that per volume, a bird has actually many more neurons in the brain than a mammal. So yes, their brains are smaller, but they're sort of high-powered in that regard.
Yeah. I just think it's amazing they can fly, don't you?
I think it is amazing. I think flight is, you know, that's the one thing I'm often jealous of.
Me too, yeah. Yeah, it'd be great to be able to fly. Lynn, thanks very much for your call. Gary in Baskerville, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a story about a pair of rare trumpeter swans that I've been photographing for 3 years now. Spend quite a few hours every year photographing them, watch them raise their cygnets. And there's no way that anybody who spends a lot of time, especially photographing wildlife and watching their behavior, can come to the conclusion that they're anything except intelligent, very intelligent, just on a different level than what we can connect with. And I've watched these swans. The first year they had had 6 young ones and lost 2, probably to snapping turtles. The second year they had 6 and lost 1. And this year they've had 7 and lost 1. So the amount of youngsters that they've raised each year has been increasing. And I've watched them chase animals away from their youngsters. I watched them get on the backs of snapping turtles and bite them and thrash them to drive them away. I've watched the 2 adults pull together and herd the youngsters between them to protect them from a predator and the cattails. There's just no way that you can watch this stuff and observe it and not understand that it has a really highly evolved sense of thought process and perception of the world around it. And the dedication of these adults to the youngsters is just, it's just marvelous. And sometimes when you watch them, you almost get tears in your eyes to watch those adults and how they are constantly 100% of the time, one or the other is always watching for danger. And the amount of effort that these adults put into protecting and raising these young cygnet swans is just mm-hmm. overwhelming to think
about.
Yeah,
that's actually, you're making a good point there in the sense that you need to watch animals do the sort of things that they have to do. So instead of, you know, the approach of intelligence in animals has often been you put a rat in a Skinner box all alone and you let the rat press a lever and you see how he does that and how often he does that and how well he learns and so on. That's a very artificial situation. And if you watch animals in a situation where they have to solve problems, like in this case they have young ones and they have predators and they have to solve the problem of how to deal with that, then you get a very different kind of learning and problem solving, and you get more sort of an impression of their true kind of intelligence. And I think what we have been doing in the past is very sort of artificial type testing, not related to what animals normally do. You need to know the animal in the wild and what they do, and then you can maybe test them in the laboratory, but on a task that seems related. That's the approach that many people follow at the moment.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have kept and studied jackdaws. If you can tell us a little bit more about those and never had any doubt about their behavior or flexibility.
The jackdaw is a little corvid, meaning it's of the crow family. It's let's say a small crow. That is how they look, and they live in Europe, and they usually nest in churches and things like that, in high towers, and they often fall out of the nest, and then you find them. And as a child, I very often raised young jackdaws, and most of the time I would release them. But later, when I was a little bit older, I tried to tame them and to keep them with me, even though most of the time in the fall, when all these jackdaws get together, they would leave. And they're very intelligent birds. It's a bit like that family is a little bit like the parrots. It's a large-brained bird family. And we now know of the crow family that they can even use tools, that they can understand cause and effect. There's all sorts of experiments now on the crow family that mimic the experiments that we have done on chimpanzees and other primates. Mm. And they hold up very well. The crow family holds up very well against the primates.
Mm. Gary, thanks for your call. Alice in New London, hi.
Hi. I've got a cat that enjoys sitting on a shelf and looking out the window. And it didn't take too many mornings of me getting up, unlocking the window, opening it up for him, when one morning he sat there and he's looking at me while I'm doing this. And later on, when I closed it, he went to the window. He stood up in his hind legs, put his front paws on the top of the window where the lock was, and put a paw on either side of it.
Wow.
So it makes one wonder if mm-hmm. our domestic pets, who have such opportunity to observe, if they had opposable thumbs, just what they could do.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to have them to get too big, for example. They would start dominating you if you're careful. You know?
Yeah, they probably would. And I wanted you to talk about some other stories of animals taking care of their young, brought to mind by our previous caller. You talk about, and I'm wondering what this tells us about intelligence, the chimps whose moms were, I don't know, having a little afternoon chit-chat or whatever, and the chimps, their children started going at each other, really fighting with each other.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
This happened when I was a student and I was watching chimps at the Arnhem Zoo. We had a very powerful female there who actually just died 2 months ago. Her name was Mama, and she died at the age of 59.
Oh, my gosh.
She was the alpha female of that group for a very long time, and she was very respected by everyone. And she was asleep while two mothers were sitting there next to her, and these mothers were watching their kids play, and young chimpanzees, and these kids were wrestling and all. Everything seemed fine and peaceful until the two juveniles, they got into a big screaming fight. And so at that moment, these mothers didn't know what to do, because if one of them steps in, and actually I hear that at daycare centers this is not an unusual situation, if one of the mothers steps in, then the other one feels that they need to defend their kid, mm-hmm. because the mothers are always biased and always in favor of their own kid, of course. And so the two females didn't know what to do because they didn't dare to step into the fight and get into a fight with the other mother. And so one of them went to old Mama, who was sleeping, and poked her in the side and woke her up. And this old female then, within one second, she knew what was going on. She stood up and she gave a big bark to those two kids. And they immediately stopped because she was so respected and they wouldn't dare to continue. So they immediately stopped, and that was the solution to the problem. But it showed that these two females who faced the dilemma of whether they would step in or not, they understood that there was a third party who they could activate, who could solve the problem for them.
Mm. Thanks, Alice, for your call. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Hi. I've always been amused by people who make the assertion, you know, they'll talk about human behavior and they'll say, well, we're not animals. And I pause and I think, sometimes I even say, well, that's kind of news to me.
Because
we most
are.
Definitely are animals. And if anyone who's ever read much about, you know, the history of thinking about animals in relationship to human beings, go back to Jeremy Bentham, and he said, you know, the question isn't whether they can reason or they can they talk, it's can they suffer. And that's a very low threshold to think about what you're doing to another living, sentient being in the world. And on that note, not to be too nasty about it, but I think just looking at the people who are in the presidential race right now, it's not whether can they talk, but can they reason, and they make me suffer almost on a daily basis. So I'm bewildered by the superiority human beings feel towards the rest of their fellow animals. It just doesn't make any sense.
The politicians are an interesting category, because I wrote a book called Chimpanzee Politics, which was based on all the power politics among male chimpanzees. And each time I see a bunch of Republican men, like we have seen in the last couple of months, comparing anatomy with each other and insulting each other and putting each other down and blustering and putting up big voices, and I have to think of my chimpanzees. For me, it's not very different what they're doing. And for me, it's a very interesting time to watch all this politics that is going on, because the interesting thing now is that, of course, the candidate against whom they're going to run is probably a female candidate, and the same sort of blustering and intimidation is not going to work in the same way. You cannot go on with this if you're in front of a female. So it's going to be very interesting how this is going to work out and who will win and how they will win, you know.
Thanks, Rich, so much for your call. Ron in La Crosse, hi.
Yes, well, ever since Charles Darwin put out on the Origin of Species, I think, you know, before that, we felt that, you know, we were at the top of creation as far as, you know, the animal kingdom and everything. And going back even centuries before that, we thought we were at the center not only of our own solar system, but at the universe. And, of course, that fell by the wayside with Galileo, who became not a martyr of the church, but a martyr for astronomy and science. And now, after Charles Darwin, we're going on further realizing that, hey, you know, we may have the biggest brains or maybe the most neurons, maybe not, but we're going to realize that, you know, we're basically an accident of evolution, as I suppose most creatures, and that kind of flies in the face of traditional perspective as to what our place is in creation.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the number of neurons, because this is another thing that happened, which was really interesting, is that at some point, we know that humans have the largest brain relative to the body, but at some point, a scientist like 5 years ago said, maybe we should not look at the size of the brain, maybe we should just count the number of neurons in the brain. And at that time, it was believed that humans had by far the most neurons in the brain, and so everyone was sort of happy, yes, we're going to go with the neuron count. Until 2 years ago, a team found that actually the elephant has 3 times more neurons than we do.
Really?
So now everyone is sort of confused and upset, because now they don't know what to do anymore, because the elephant clearly has more neurons than we do.
Whew. Well, I'll be interested in development of that story. And we also study, you write, the neurons of rats, because they're similar to our neurons, right?
Well, the brains of all the mammals are very similar. So basically the human brain is a large monkey brain. It's not very different in structure or neurons. It's basically a more powerful computer, so to speak, but it's not a different computer. And that's something we have known for a long time. That's why so many studies of, let's say, phobias or memory are done on rats, is because all the mammalian brains are essentially similar.
Hmm. Thank you so much for your call, Ron. And we go to David in Ironwood. Hi.
Yes. My thing is, I recently saw a show about they put some radioactive carbon into a pine tree, and actually some of it went down into the roots to the ceiling. So here, I never would think that the pine tree would even care about its young, but this evidence shows that. There's four values: beauty, truth, freedom, love, that living things sort of share that non-living things don't. I mean, I think it's maybe that's the key to consciousness. Just the humans just happen to be toward the top of that. You know, the more intelligent you be, the more you can choose, the more you can appreciate, the more you can care and choose.
Yeah. Usually we talk about animals when we talk about sentience being sensitive to others and being affected by others and being able to suffer and so on. But, you know, it's a very artificial distinction between animals and plants. And there is really no reason to exclude plants of that picture. And there's increasingly evidence now. There's a book going to come on the market in September by a forester, a German forester. I think it's called something, The Feelings of Plants or whatever. And, yes, this whole line between animals and plants, they're all organisms. They all have to survive. They all have ways of doing that, and just because plants are more slow than animals in terms of what they do and are stationary doesn't mean that they are not open to that kind of experiences.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your call. You asked the question, what's the answer? Do animals say goodbye as well as hello?
That came up, and that has to do with thinking ahead or thinking backwards. Saying hello is, of course, very common. If you come home and you have a dog, and the dog is going to jump at you, and the dog is recognizing you, of course, and there is a certain greeting ceremony, and greeting between animals is very, very common. But saying goodbye requires that you know that you're going to be separated.
Mm-hmm.
Saying goodbye, you know that with very young children, you can say goodbye, but they don't understand what you're talking about. Mm. And the same is true with a dog. You can say goodbye, but the dog doesn't know. But in the chimpanzees, we had a female chimp that we had to call out of the group regularly because we were using her to raise a baby chimp on the bottle, and we had to fill the bottle and all of this. And so in the middle of the day, we would call her out of the group. She would be living on an island. And she would do the rounds and say goodbye. She would visit, before she would come into the building, she would visit the most important members of the group. And if they were asleep, she would wake them up, give them a kiss. And she gave all of them a kiss before she would come into. And she did that every day. And since she did it so regularly, I started documenting it. And I called it saying goodbye, because she was basically doing that in anticipation of the separation.
And how did the other chimps respond? Did they have some sense of her leaving? Was there any...
I think they understood what was going on. Yeah, I think chimpanzees understand all these things.
Yeah. When do chimps kiss each other, or apes, or bonobos, or whatever?
Chimps kiss most of the time under exactly the circumstances where humans kiss. They kiss when they greet, and they kiss when they reconcile. So after a fight between, let's say, two males or two females, they, like 10 minutes later, they will approach each other, and then they embrace and kiss each other, and that's called a reconciliation. So that's a typical context for kissing for them.
Hmm. More phone calls. We welcome them. For Frans de Waal, our guest this hour, he has a brand new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? He's written all kinds of books, and he studied primates for a number of years, since the 1970s, actually. He has been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. He's the author of Our Inner Ape, and he's happy to be an ape. He is a professor in Emory University's Psychology Department, director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. Our phone number for you to join this conversation, you may have your own stories or you may have questions about animals, because he sure has studied many of them, birds and reptiles and and chimps and elephants and crows and all kinds of animals who exhibit their own unique intelligence that in many cases is very sophisticated. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to have your messages there. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Are there studies you want to tell us about that you're doing right now, Franz Wall, that are cutting edge? I know you're always doing something that's phenomenally interesting. What are you looking at?
Well, actually, one of the things we're doing at the moment is what we call yawn contagion. So you will yawn when someone next to you yawns, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's related to empathy because actually people who are highly empathic, they have more yawn, they're more sensitive to the yawns.
Oh.
And you can do it with dogs, you can do it with apes. It has been done with dogs. So you play a video of the owner yawning and then you see what the dog does. Dogs will yawn. And with apes, with the chimps, we show them little videos on an iPod. We show them videos of chimps that they know who are yawning or chimps that they don't know, that they've never seen before, who are yawning. And they're only affected by the yawns of the ones that they know. And this is something that we also know of humans, is that in human studies, you're much more sensitive to the yawns of your family members or your friends than of a stranger. And so this is all related to the empathy research that we do, and it's very easy to do, and it's sort of fun to watch also.
Why do we yawn?
Well, yawning itself is not completely understood.
Oh.
Yawning is found in so many animals, from lizards to mammals to birds, all sorts of animals yawn, and we don't really know exactly why. Some people say it is to cool the brain, but, you know, since fish also yawn, I don't know what brain cooling they need to do in the water there. So I don't think that's a very solid hypothesis.
It is an unusual thing. I was just yawning just to try to make myself yawn when you were talking about it.
As soon as you show people pictures of yawning cats or dogs, they start yawning.
Let's go to Michael in Madison. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
So I had a question. It was a conversation that I was having the other day with one of my friends about the intelligence of animals, and I had brought up how dogs and other mammals feel pain, and he was saying, no, it's really just more of like discomfort. The way they feel pain, they don't really have an emotional response to it. They just know that something is happening that shouldn't be, and then they just try and avoid the pain. They don't have the ability to really fight through pain the way people can. And I was just wondering maybe if you could talk about, you know, how people and other animals feel pain differently and how they respond to it and why that might be.
And how they take care of others.
Yeah, we usually have this discussion about fish because the people have a discussion about whether fish feel pain, yes or no. About mammals, I think in science there's no one who assumes that they don't feel pain because everything is homologous, as we call it, in the sense that the brains are so similar, their experiences must be very similar. So yes, they avoid painful stimuli, but we humans do that as well. That's not a proof that they don't feel them. So I would assume that a dog will feel very similarly. But we have that discussion sometimes about fish. But the conclusion actually of many people is that since fish can learn from painful experiences, you can do experiments on fish where they have painful experiences and they start to learn how to avoid them.
Mm.
Since they learn from them, they must feel them. Otherwise, why would they learn from them? So we have concluded, even for the fish, that there must be an experience associated with the pain.
I know there's some examples, and please tell us whichever ones you'd like in the book, of animals taking care of each other when they are in pain, when they're elderly.
Yeah.
What do they do, and what kind of intelligence is it a sign of, Franz?
Yeah, so you have all sorts of caretaking, of course, from very simple, like maternal care and things like that, but you sometimes have very complex. Like we had a very old female in one of our groups of chimps who could barely walk anymore. She had arthritis, and she had a lot of trouble walking and certainly climbing. And younger females, if this old female wanted to join, for example, a grooming cluster of chimps, up in the climbing structure, the young females would push her up to get her there. Or we've also seen young females, if this old female started walking towards the drinker where she would get water, and which was a long distance away because it's a very large enclosure, we saw younger females rush ahead of her and suck up a lot of water and then run back to her and spit it in her mouth so that she didn't need to go all that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw helping behavior, which was, in my mind, quite insightful.
Yeah, that's a great observation. Let's go. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Jessica in Bellevue. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I love your show and your guests.
Thanks, Jessica.
I just wanted to follow up with the greeting of a dog. I have a 10-pound Pomeranian named Samson, and he's just got so much character. You can see the smarts in his eyes, you know. Anyway, just real short, I wanted to say that he, of course, he greets. He has springs in his legs, but when I'm leaving, he'll bark kind of frantic a little until I say, I'll see you later, and then he's fine. He calms down.
Yeah, but if, whether he understands what you mean, that's hard to test. I don't know how I would test that, but I've never heard that dogs, or young children for that matter, fully understand what that means. I'll see you later. But yeah, this may be something reassuring. I don't know to what degree it is. Yeah.
Mm. Well, I've noticed, I don't know if you've noticed this, Jessica, if I'm going for a long period of time, when the suitcases come out, hide myself behind the couch. My dog does that, and just, you know, we'll do it for a day and a half because he knows what's going on. I should learn. I'm not as intelligent as he is to hide the suitcase and wait to the last minute. Whereas if I'm going to work, I'm just carrying one bag. He doesn't seem to be nearly as unhappy. I don't know what I'm reading into that, but he seems to have a sense, at least, when it's a long trip and when it's a short trip.
Yeah, I think that's something that through association they can learn, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Jessica, for your call. Let's go to Joe in Barrington. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Very thought-provoking. Many, many, many years ago, I studied Thomistic philosophy and metaphysics. And one of the few things I remember from all of those courses was that we do share senses with both animals and plants, as I was taught. And that there are 24 common senses. Please don't ask me to name them. But I remember a professor explaining to us that there are two senses that humans possess that animals do not. And he pointed out the sense of reason and reflection and how we put those two together in an ethical, moral sense to form societies and on and on and on.
Hmm.
So I'm just wondering how your guest would feel. Oh, and by the way, the professor gave the example that you have never seen a lion on trial for murder because he does not possess both reason and reflection. He cannot moralize or reflect on taking another life, and that taking of that life is merely done for his survival. It's something programmed in him.
Mm-hmm.
We were also taught that you know, things like dogs and cats can feel pain. They can feel. They have a sense of humor. They have a sense of grief, longing, etc. But this reason and reflection combination was always something that kind of stuck with me. So I was wondering what your guest would think.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to start a whole new legal practice here, but what would your guest think if a lion was taken into court for murder?
Okay.
Yeah, so actually in medieval times, animals were put in front of a judge. If a bull would kill a farmer, for example, they would be judged. And they might be hanged or something like that. Imagine hanging a bull for that kind of stuff. So, but people did that. And even today, for example, I still remember there was a polar bear at the Vilas Park Zoo in Madison who attacked somebody, and somebody who had climbed into the enclosure, and the polar bear was shot. So even today we have this sort of attitude like it was his fault instead of the human fault in this case, I think, but they faulted the bear who attacked. And so we still have sort of moral judgment sometimes about animals that seem to me inappropriate. But I do feel that animals do have reasoning power and do have reflection power, not to the degree maybe that they have complex decisions about what is right and what is wrong in the way we do in our moral systems. But I've written about the evolution of morality, and I do feel that a lot of the things that we put into morality, which has to do with empathy and sympathy and the sense of fairness, we do actually experiments on the sense of fairness in our primates. All these things are possible in other species. So it is a bit absolute to say that they have nothing of it, even though I do think humans have more of it, clearly, than they do.
But some humans probably have less of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who are not nearly as moral as we would want them to be. So what are they doing, you know?
Right. Thanks, Joe, so much for your call. Linda in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. This was talked about a little bit earlier, but I was thinking about we were taking care of a friend's place for them while they were on an extended vacation, and they had chickens, and we weren't real good at doing the chickens right, and we found an egg that had been laid not in the nest boxes, and we didn't know how long it had been there, and there was a hen that was sitting there, so we figured that there was a chick growing in there, so we brought it in, put it in an aquarium with a little light bulb for a heater, and hatched out this little chicken. And then we were worried that because it hatched out with us indoors, that if we put it back out there, the other chickens might pick on it. So when the owner got back, he said, no, we'll put it out with the other chickens. So it turned out that was a little hen, and we left. We'd been gone for several years. And when we came back, we were staying on their property there in our motorhome. And there was a little hen that would always, they could hear us when they're getting ready to go out of the trailer or the camper. And she would come running, and she'd be standing there at the bottom of the steps looking up at us like, oh, here they come. So we determined that. After talking to John, he said, that's that hen that you guys hatched out, that she remembered us all that time.
That doesn't surprise me. That many animals have excellent memory. I heard recently, actually, someone who raised a praying mantis, and the mantis, this is an insect, recognized them and would fly on their shoulder and not somebody else's shoulder. So yeah, the recognition and memory you find in many species. It's not that complicated, I think, and I'm not surprised that chickens have it.
That's a great story. Thank you, Linda, so much for your call. Stephanie in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I have a quick question. I have a cat. He's about 12 years old now. And every morning, between 15 to 20 minutes before my alarm goes off, he comes in the room and wakes me up. I am wondering, is this something normal that a cat would do, or is he learning, like, difference between day and night? It's just really weird, because I've never had any other animal do that to me other than him.
Well, the day and night shifts, of course, and so if he were to do that, it would be each day would be a different time, I suppose, in the winter versus the summer, for example. Now, and I think animals have a very good sense of time, in the same way that if we would throw away all our watches and clocks, we would probably have a very good sense of time. Nowadays, we look at the clock, but we have a very good sense of when we should be eating and when we should be sleeping.
Right.
All of this. I think that's what's going on with your cat.
And really, all you have to do is look at the sun if it's out, and you can pretty much tell what time it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you, Franz Dewall. I love the book, and I just love this area of conversation. It's just fascinating, isn't it?
So, yeah, I stay fascinated, yeah.
I know you do, and you keep writing about it. Thank you so much for doing that. Franz Dewall, our guest, his book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? He's been with us. He's written a lot of books, and as you heard him say, he spent 10 years at teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also spent a lot of time studying the bonobos at the Milwaukee County Zoo. He is a professor of history at Emory University in the psychology, and he's a professor of psychology in the psychology department and director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. Very interesting person. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show, and to Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Next show Monday, All Things Political, another edition, and our guest is the politics editor for the National Journal. We'll talk about the FBI's report on the Clinton emails, and we will be only a week away from the National Republican Convention, so we'll talk about that as well as the primary season starts to come to a close. So that's All Things Political. Our next show Monday, it will be at 1 o'clock. Thanks very much for listening and for all your great calls this hour. News is next from National Public Radio.